Spirit Blade Underground, episode 452. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 452.
And welcome to the monitor room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment. Is anybody saying this with me at the same time right now? Does anybody say this in unison with me? Email me or put a comment or something if you do something. You'll get, like, I don't know, some no prize nerdy points or something. Anyway, this podcast is a celebration, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as being the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and like me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, a review of the live-action Ghost in the Shell movie, and in a new segment, we journey into the long box with Winston Crutchfield and look at some great Dungeons & Dragons comic books. Plus, some thoughts on being both humble and gentle as geeks as we continue in the book of Ephesians. All right, let's get to it. Ghost in the Shell, starring Scarlett Johansson. The synopsis provided by Paramount Pictures on IMDb.com reads, in the near future, Major, which is so weird. I saw the original anime, and I was like, her name is Major? Something's gotta be lost in translation there. Anyway, in the near future, Major is the first of her kind, a human saved from a terrible crash who is cyber-enhanced to be a perfect soldier devoted to stopping the world's most dangerous criminals. When terrorism reaches a new level that includes the ability to hack into people's minds and control them, Major is uniquely qualified to stop it. As she prepares to face a new enemy, Major discovers that she has been lied to. And then I'm going to leave out, they tell you what the lie is. In somewhat uncertain terms, but still, I'm like, that's too much. And there's a line in the trailer, I'm like, that's too much. You shouldn't be saying that much. So I'm going to leave that out. She's been lied to. She will stop at nothing to recover her past, find out who did this to her, and stop them before they do it to others. Based on the internationally acclaimed Japanese manga, The Ghost in the Shell, which I did see the animated movie, as I mentioned, long, long time ago. I'm not reviewing this as, you know, like, evaluating how well it holds to the original material. I'm not a particular fan of the original one. I mean, I liked it. I saw it. I was like, oh, this is cool. I'd never seen really anime like this, apart from maybe Akira with this really kind of serious, dark, you know, storytelling. But I did enjoy it. I'm just not like, oh my gosh, I'm a huge Ghost in the Shell fan. But I might be getting a little closer in that direction after seeing this movie. I really did enjoy it. Spoilers. Okay, so let's talk about the story, the script, and the pacing a little bit. This is not like a wall-to-wall action sci-fi movie, despite the trailers maybe implying that, or maybe what they've shown of the movie in various places. It's not like this huge action fest all the way through. Now, it does have a good number of action sequences, and I would say it is an action movie, but it's equally, you know, a sci-fi mystery. You know, there's plenty of time where you're just kind of like in the world and you're following the main characters as they're slowly uncovering this mystery, and that's broken up quite frequently with action. But it's not like this mindless, certainly not mindless, but it's not like a mainly an action movie. There's a good amount of world building just through strange imagery presented in the movie, and you might think from watching some of the trailers, is this movie going to be too weird for me? Am I going to understand what the crap is going on? But what's cool is that the story itself is a pretty straightforward mystery. But for, you know, there's still so much going on in the world It takes place in a futuristic Japan, and but I mean that doesn't say the half of it, because it's clear to me from the movie that there's been so much blending of cultures that has happened by this point in the future, and there's just all these different weird things that people are doing that have to do with technology, but there's also, you know, maybe some kind of like strange religious stuff going on at the same time, just based on the visuals. So there's a lot to look at and say, what is that about? And yet you don't need to know what the heck that is about in order to follow the story. So it's a easy story to follow, but like, you know, it probably a really difficult world to totally understand. And I love that kind of combination. So let's see here. It was a little bit quiet at times, which I didn't mind until about the end of the second act, right just before the beginning of the third act. I was like, okay, you're not revealing information at the pace that I would quite like in order to really keep me engaged. But that was just a brief moment, and then it started revealing basically everything at the end, and also brought the characterization to the character motives to the forefront. It's not like a hugely character-driven movie, at least not in the sense that I felt like emotionally involved. Until the end, I was surprised. Suddenly in the climax, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm totally invested in Major's story, in what she wants to accomplish. I'm feeling for what she's lost. And I was even kind of moved nearly to tears in the final resolution of her story. So that was a really cool surprise, in addition to just enjoying kind of the mystery, the strange world, and the action. Let's see here. In talking just briefly about the cast, the strength, I would say, in the cast is more in the casting than in particularly, you know, outstanding performances. You know, we've got Scarlett Johansson, and she's, to my mind, kind of playing just more a more stoic version of Black Widow in this. It's not something wildly different by any stretch from what we've seen her do before. But there's a lot of, like, unfamiliar faces in this movie that are just kind of like briefly in the scene sometimes, and they're just like interesting characters. Like one guy that she interacts with who's just like for some reason sweating, like to a level that no one else in the room is sweating. He's just this sweaty, greasy guy, and there's something weird about, and there's all kinds of characters that just have this one thing about them, or two things about them, that's just kind of like, what is up there, you know? And so some of that's the casting too, is in addition to, you know, the makeup and stuff like that. So there's also Juliette Binoche, who was, I didn't know her name before I looked it up, but a very familiar face to me. She's often in these supporting roles or kind of in smaller dramas and stuff. And she stood out to me in this movie as a warm emotional center for Major as a character, you know, and kind of providing the connection to Major's humanity as she's sorting through, you know, how human is she, and, you know, what is left of her humanity when she can't trust her memories and all she is a brain in a synthetic body, you know. Anyway, I'll get back to some of that, you know, philosophical stuff in just a little bit. Let's talk about the stunts and visuals just briefly. There are visual effects in almost every frame of this movie, and most of it is just kind of like incidental world-building type stuff. There are, like, at least three different, completely different varieties of holograms. There's one where you are communicating to somebody, like doing like a, you know, FaceTime, but the hologram version. There are holograms that are like billboards, and those are different. They're more transparent, and they're not structured the same way. There are holograms that people interact with in order to operate technology, and each of these different types of holograms looks very different, you know, and has a different vibe to it entirely. And that's just the holograms. I mean, there's all kinds of visual stuff going on in this movie that's just fascinating. And you could pause it. You know, there's like passing shots where it's like, whoa, what was that? I would love to pause and go back and just watch that little section of the screen for a little bit, you know. And there's just so much visually going on in this movie that's really interesting. What else? Oh, yeah, there's cybernetic limbs that people just have, you know, that are a combination of makeup and visual effects in order to achieve them. So it's this great mix of practical stuff, you know, with like animatronics and makeup and stuff like that, and CG. It's this handing back and forth that really kind of helps sell the CG. When you have as much practical stuff as they do, you know, it can make me kind of guess for just a moment, even though I'm cursed with an eye to pick out CG. It's like, oh, is that CG or da da da? Or sometimes I just get tired of keeping track because it's they go back and forth enough that I don't get distracted as much by just the constant barrage of, you know, CG. So there's also some cool slow-mo action, you know, in the fight sequences. But the choreography and the fight sequences and the, you know, the way it's shot and all that kind of stuff, it's not groundbreaking. It's just plenty cool, you know, and that was good enough for me. All right, so let's talk about the philosophy a little bit. I do try to ask myself when playing a game or taking, you know, in fiction of any kind, is there anything of a worthwhile moral or philosophical or spiritual significance going on in here that would stimulate worthwhile thought or conversation? And I think that's definitely true in this movie. The main slogan of the movie, paraphrased, it's not quite this, is, "We cling so much to our memories because we think they define us, but it's what we do that defines us." And that's interesting because that's kind of a, we've heard that before from Christian Bale's Batman in Batman Begins, and it's not entirely true from a biblical perspective. Now, by default, what we do defines our position before God. The Bible tells us that all have sinned and fall short of God's perfect standard of holiness, and therefore we are not compatible, if he's going to be a just God, to be with him and to be in the perfect environment that he is longing to create and live in with us. So we're not compatible for that. And so there's definitely a sense in which what we do defines our relationship to God, and by default that leaves us all separated from God. But for those who turn to Jesus for rescue and forgiveness, his perfect record of righteousness is painted over theirs. And so they are completely redefined by Jesus, by what Jesus has done, and by the love that Jesus has for us. And likewise, whether we're talking about a Christian or a non-Christian, God defines our worth, our significance, our value, because he made us in his image, which is a little bit vague in the Bible. We don't know exactly what that means, but in some way we are made to reflect who God is. And then on top of that, God chose to invest love in us and to live a really hard, difficult life of rejection and a torturous death, also that it would be possible for us to have a restored relationship with him. And so it's really God, in the way that he made us and in the way that he invests in us, that really defines us, defines our significance in the universe, and defines our value and our characteristics. And so our own attempts to define ourselves through what we do, as this movie wants to say, that falls immeasurably short of how God, our maker, has defined us. The movie also presents the idea that our soul, our mind, or as it calls it most of the movie, our ghost, is ultimately immaterial. It has a strong connection to our brain, but our brain seems to be at best an interface or a connection point between our immaterial being and our material bodies and the material world. And this is a pretty rare treatment, in my experience, of human consciousness in science fiction. Science fiction normally is going to take a naturalistic, a hard naturalistic, or an atheistic view and say that our minds are really, it's really just electrical impulses in our brain, and that's it. There is nothing immaterial going on. Whereas from a biblical perspective, there is an immaterial component with us, and then ultimately our intended form is composed of both material and immaterial aspects. But we are not just this material, you know, matter. That's being redundant, isn't it? Material matter. So that was cool to see. And so hopefully this story can encourage other mainstream, big-budget, blockbuster sci-fi movies to be freed up from that traditional hard naturalism that science fiction usually takes. And I think that freeing ourselves up from that kind of worldview in science fiction allows for much more thought-provoking stories, such as the treatment of the immaterial being in Battlestar Galactica, as we question, are the Cylons, you know, human or not, and stuff like that, or in a story like this. There's more questions that are up in the air and that are interesting to probe than if we commit ourselves from the start to a purely naturalistic worldview. So it's, I think it's better philosophy and theology, and I also think it makes for better just plain storytelling, whether you're a believer in Christ or not. All right, so I have no idea what your tastes are, but if I were a time traveler, I would go back in time and say, hey, Peter, dude, go see this one and just plan to buy it too. And while you're at it, before you go to the theater, see if you can track down the original Ghost in the Shell anime movies and the TV series, because you're going to be itching to go back and check those out again after you've seen this movie, if nothing else, so that you can just spend a little bit more time with this really striking, unusual world and its striking characters. It's rated PG-13 for intense sequences of sci-fi violence, suggestive content, and some disturbing images. I want to remind you guys to go check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POSTOS, and Helix Reviews. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Welcome to a new episode of Into the Long Box. I'm your host, Winston Crutchfield, and we will be exploring topics of comic literature throughout the ages, and only the best interpretations thereof.
Dad, why are you British?
Who are you talking to?
How did you fit an entire orchestra in the living room?
Mom's gonna freak.
I don't remember exactly how I stumbled onto Humble Bundle. It probably came up in one of the forums or news groups I read. However it happened, I arrived just in time to purchase their Dungeons & Dragons digital comic book bundle. The bundle included the complete runs of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons and Forgotten Realms books that DC Comics had published in the 80s and 90s. It hadn't really been on my radar at the time. I was mostly into superhero books. At the moment, though, I was craving good fantasy adventure, and wanted something to go along with our current D&D campaign. Good value, good cause, great buy. Better than I knew. The bundle also included the more recent books published by IDW. When I flipped open the first pages of Legends of Baldur's Gate, I discovered hidden treasure. It was there that I met a desperate elven sorcerer named Delina, on the run from the minions of the Cult of the Dragon, and unable to wield her wild magic effectively. Her flight leads her to Baldur's Gate and the Statue of Minsk, the beloved ranger, who generations before was one of the original heroes of Baldur's Gate. Delina's wild magic brings him to life, and the fight is on! Minsk's first words struck a chord deep within me, ringing a note I hadn't realized I'd been desperately missing. "Stand down, dirty minions of evil, or face my hamster's wrath!" Here stood a hero. I'd pretty much given up on comic books entirely 5 or 6 years before. The current generation of creators simply weren't telling stories I wanted to read. My present comics consumption consisted of a scant handful of webcomics that I read whenever I remembered to catch up. Suddenly, I remembered how much I loved this art form, and how much I missed it. I have more than 2 decades worth of back issues and a wide variety of titles, but there is joy in the discovery of new material, entirely separate from the nostalgia of rereading favorite stories. I now had a new hero. The more I read, the more familiar he seemed, until a soft light finally dawned. It was as if Ben Edlund had come to his senses and fled the insanity of Hollywood to return to his roots. If the Tick wore chainmail and fought evil with a broadsword, this is what it would look like. The rest of the book remained rooted in the serious pseudo-realism of dramatic fantasy, without the trappings of the absurd that made the Tick's entire world surreal. Minsk, however, perfectly echoed that hero's oblivious optimism and charisma. He was that one guy at the gaming table, the one who just shows up to have fun and smite evil while the rest of the party deals with their intrigues and personal drama. I flipped to the credits page, fully expecting to see Edlund's name as the headline. Jim Zub? Never heard of him. Let's see, Skull Kickers. I've heard of that, but I've never read it. Pathfinder comics. Oh, I saw those in the store, but I never bothered to look at them. Samurai Jack? How on earth did I miss a Samurai Jack comic? That would be awesome. Figment. My daughter loves that book. This could be pretty good, I figure, but I'll save my verdict for the end of the book. I loved it. I loved reading comics again. The bitterness and frustration of the past few years washed away with the discovery of new heroes, irredeemable evil, and a sense of adventure with momentum like a freight train. I was excited when IDW announced a new Dungeons & Dragons series that would follow up with the characters of Baldur's Gate story. This new book would also be penned by Zub and feature vampire Count Strahd von Zarevich as the principal antagonist. Excellent. With some temerity, I began to investigate other comics. I quickly shied away from the Marvel and DC superheroes when a glance at the shelves revealed the continuing presence of the same elements that had previously driven me away. I landed at Titan and picked up a new line of Doctor Who books. I drifted past DC and noticed they were going to try and reinvigorate the Hanna-Barbera properties. Archie Comics called to me with the presence of Mark Waid's name on the cover of a reimagining of the Riverdale Gang, and a trade paperback showcasing Mega Man squaring off against Sonic the Hedgehog. Once again, I could read and enjoy comic books. But I had to finish reading my stock of Dungeons & Dragons books first. They were all pretty good. Alex Irvine and Peter Bergton took me to the world of Dark Sun and the quest of a slave for survival and freedom. Paul Crilly reminded me that comics told mystery stories as well in the world of Eberron. John Rogers and Andrea DeVito introduced me to Fells Five in the Forgotten Realms, a party of adventurers drawn directly from my gaming table, but who didn't shy away from the consequences of their actions or the implications of their powers. And, of course, no one does the Forgotten Realms, quite like R.A. Salvatore and Dritz Do'Urden. And then only Jim Zub and Legends of Baldur's Gate remained. While Minsk and Boo tackled the forces of evil with tireless good cheer and inevitable purpose, the rest of the party rebelled against their parents, quested to save their family, or hung around simply because they had nowhere else to go. The stakes of the story rose to a fiery crescendo that swelled and crashed in a wave of action and tide of ebbing emotion. The pacing kept me turning pages, torn between astonishment at each panel and a desperate need to see what happened next. The characters involved me in their personal motivations and desires without dragging me into a morass of juvenile emotional obsession or pedantic explanations of the obvious. The party's adventurers continued in the next volume with Shadows of the Vampire. The corruption of the realm of Ravenloft touched the heroes, laying bare their weakness and beating them down against the power of Strahd and his ability to destroy hope. Through it all, Zub continually threw the actions of hero and villain into sharp contrast, filling the world with people who are selfish, desperate, and compassionate. The stories haven't delved deep into the philosophical discussions of the fantasy realm. They haven't explored the implications of a world populated by deific monsters and mortals who can challenge the gods. But they haven't needed to. Zub's stories possess humanity. These are the people we hope we would be if we found ourselves on their world. I met Zub at the 2016 Gen Con quite by chance. He was working a booth for his publisher, I presume, and I saw the display of skull kickers and D&D trades. I commented to my wife that it would be very cool if I could get a signed copy of Legends of Baldur's Gate. From the other side of the display, I heard a voice pipe up. I can do that. We spoke for a bit. He was very gracious and patient with me. No small feat. He's clearly a fellow comics and fantasy fan, blessed enough to be living his dream job. He convinced me to give Skullkickers a try and signed that book for me as well. Zub continues to write for the industry, picking up more work from Marvel as the writer on Thunderbolts and Avengers, for Udon Entertainment's Street Fighter license, and for Image in the pages of Wayward and Glitter Bomb. The adventures of Minsk and Delina continue in the pages of Dungeons & Dragons Frost Giant's Fury from IDW. I've picked up his entire run of Pathfinder comics. Skullkickers is next on my shortlist. I give Jim Zub's Dungeons & Dragons books a quality score of excellent and a relevance score of high.
Data collection complete. Activating MusicNet 1.0.
This week at ChristianGeekCentral.com, you can find our review of Power Rangers written by Winston Crutchfield, plus Winston's article Into the Long Box, Dungeons and Dragons by Jim Zub, featuring interior artwork from the comics. So if you were interested in what he had to share about the comics, but you're thinking to yourself, well, I wonder what they look like, you can actually check out the art and see if it connects with you in his article at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Also at YouTube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. This week you'll find episode 4 of my Gloomhaven solo playthrough, which I've been having a lot of fun with, and it's about to start going completely off the rails. I won't say more than that, but episode 4 is kind of like the foreshadowing episode to when it all starts going off the rails. So anyway, you're invited to check that out. It's going to be that series is going to be published on an every other week basis. Semi-weekly? It's not bi-weekly, right? Because bi-weekly is twice a week. So semi-weekly? I don't know. Anyway, every other week. what I'm trying to do going forward, and I'm not officially like promoting it this way because I don't know yet if I'll be able to do it consistently, but what I'm going to start aiming for now and just trying out to see if I can do it, based on actually some feedback when I asked for some feedback on the YouTube channel a little while ago, is to consistently every Thursday have gaming related content, and then every Friday have movie or TV related content. I'm not sure how consistent I'll be able to be with that, but I'm going to give that a shot and just see if I can get into enough of a rhythm. And if I can, then I'll create a new promo for the channel and include that updated kind of promotional aspect of it or whatever. Because that's what the kiddies like. They like consistency and they like predictability, right? I don't know who the kiddies are, but that's what the cool postmodern people say on other YouTube channels when they're talking about their audience. They say the kids, the kiddies, which is actually kind of like condescending, but anyway. all right, so what else? I'm babbling here. Oh, yeah. Also, at YouTube.com/ChristianGeekCentral this week, by now you should be able to find the video version of my uncut review of Ghost in the Shell, which, you know, if all you do is listen to those reviews here, you're missing out on my introductory song. I always include an introductory song that can only be heard in and seen as I perform it in the video version, in the uncut review version of my movie reviews. So, and those go up pretty much every Friday at YouTube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. So anyway, that's there if you want to see that weirdness. And while you're there, if you want to like, share, and subscribe, that does help to grow our community and raise awareness of Christian Geek Central and hopefully get more people connected. That's really what I want to see ultimately. You know, I'm not monetizing that channel, and I can't imagine it'd be a long time before I would, you know, really consider that. I've dabbled and experimented here and there, but really the reason that I want to see that community grow is I'm hoping that more and more people will connect there and then choose to come over and engage on our forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com, because I think that the people that kind of choose to engage and connect there, there's just neat things that happen. We're talking to each other, we're hanging out, we're praying for each other. We're just experiencing a little bit more of life together as much as we can in this, you know, obviously removed text-based communication. But anyway, that's my hope in growing the YouTube communities, that people will come and join us over at the website at ChristianGeekCentral.com, away from some of the YouTube noise. Could be a nasty place sometimes. Is that everything that I wanted to cover? I think it is. All right. And just a reminder, guys, if you want to help make sure Spirit Blade Productions can keep doing what we're doing or do more of it, both faster and better, you're invited to make a donation of any amount, anytime, or become a part of the Spirit Blade Insider Program and get monthly exclusive goodies. For more information, you can visit our About page at spiritblade.com. And I should mention that it is because of Spirit Blade Insiders that I was able to have the lighting equipment and the camera equipment to start this Gloomhaven series, which is really cool. It's drawn a new audience to the channel that normally hasn't interacted with that channel before. Some of the board gaming crowd, you know, and folks from Board Game Geek, you know, are watching and discovering that series and really enjoying it. And the timing was just right, you know. It seemed to be kind of God orchestrated, because it was really unusual that I was able to get my hands on a copy of Gloomhaven. It went quickly out of print. I did not pre-order. I did not back the Kickstarter. I just was persistent in calling every game store I possibly could and was told, you know, no, sorry, no, sorry, no, sorry, by, you know, all of them and maybe by two of them. And then I got a call back from, you know, one of the maybes, and it was in, and it was, you know. So that, and the fact that I had at that time the money needed, and not much more at all, to get all at once the lighting equipment and the camera equipment to get that series started. And here now, there's some people that are getting connected to this channel that would not have been otherwise. So that's just a thank you going out to the current Spirit Blade insiders who have been a part of making that happen. And then also just a way of kind of showing and demonstrating how, in a very practical, real, tangible way, it makes a difference. Every Spirit Blade insider that subscribes is making a difference. So for me to be able to do those kinds of things. So that's what I mean when I say to do more of what we're doing, both faster and better. That's an absolute example of that in practice right there. So anyway, if you want more information about what it means and kind of the goodies that you get for being a monthly subscriber to the Spirit Blade Insider program, you just go and click on About at spiritblade.com. And while you're there, of course, you're also invited to support us by purchasing a download of one of our original sci-fi or fantasy audio dramas for a friend or family member. We have these available gift codes that you can use, because you've already bought our entire library, right? Of audio dramas. No, of course you can buy for yourself if you haven't already. So you're invited and encouraged to check that stuff out. It's a great way to support everything going on at Christian Geek Central and Spirit Blade Productions, and also getting some fun stuff for you or those that you know to listen to. So again, for more information, visit spiritblade.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. And lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
All right, guys. Well, in this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the kind of the churchy language, we might call it, that we can often take for granted. Digging into history and languages, when I'm able, to try and get at the heart of the text, so we can hopefully see and apply some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in Scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth, and that's something we can all do. I hope you'll do that with me. If you're ever curious about the resources that I'm using, I also post in text form this In Search of Truth study every Sunday. It goes up on on ChristianGeekCentral.com the Sunday right after it posts in the podcast. So the podcast is usually up in the feed on Friday, and it appears on Christian Geek Central on Saturday, and then you can find the text version of In Search of Truth every Sunday at ChristianGeekCentral.com. And in each of those posts, I've been trying to get into the habit at the bottom of just including a list of the resources that I typically use, the reference books and other things like that, to put together this study, so that you know that these, you know, I'm not just making up stuff about, like, biblical history and what's going on in the Greek and the Hebrew, you know. I have to use resources because I'm not a scholar in those things. So anyway, that's just a way that you can kind of, like, you know, double check and make sure that I'm using reliable and respectable resources to come to the conclusions that I am, as I'm kind of doing exegesis as best I can on the text. So anyway, this time we're looking at Ephesians chapter 4 verses 1 through 3. In the ESV, it reads, "I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." Okay, so Paul transitions now from a heavily doctrinal focus in the chapters leading up to this to a more practical focus, although the doctrinal concepts are still interwoven in what he's talking about here and going forward. In fact, it's because of and in light of those doctrinal realities that we summarized last time, it's because of and in light of those things that we should pursue what Paul and the Holy Spirit are calling us to, beginning here in chapter 4. So looking at verse 1 now. When Paul urges readers to walk in a manner worthy of their calling, the Greek word for worthy he uses means literally bringing up the other beam of the scales, and so implies equal balance. In other words, the way we go about our daily lives should fit with what God is calling us to as his followers. It should be equivalent to. If we don't feel some sobering regret after hearing those words or reading them, if you go and read this on the website, then I don't think we have a clear view of ourselves. I think that when we hear Paul say to us that we ought to be walking in a manner worthy of our calling, that there should be a sobering feeling that comes over us. When the thought that I'm a pretty good Christian, you know, I'm a pretty good Christian, when that thought runs through my mind, I'm just comparing myself too generously, I should add, to other Christians, and failing to see what I'm actually called to. Now looking at verses 2 and 3, in case his readers should be left wondering, Paul gets specific about what it means to pursue worthiness to the call of Christ. It involves humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another in love, and an eagerness to maintain unity. And we'll start by just focusing on the first two of those, humility and gentleness. So first, humility. The Greek word used here means having a deep sense of one's moral littleness. This is a complete lack of self-importance or self-justification. We are important, and as believers we are justified, but we don't establish our own importance or justification. God does. And the moral littleness of humility involves a helpless recognition of our need for the tireless forgiveness of Jesus. You know, we can think, you know, if you've been a Christian for a long time, you can kind of think about, well, I was saved at one point in the past, you know, and now things, you know, I'm all set now. I'm good, you know. And, you know, I've talked about on this podcast before that word saved, salvation, as it's used in the New Testament, is context sensitive. And it does not just refer to that moment of transaction where you are justified and freed from the penalty of your sin and are now going to be able to be with God forever. In fact, most times being saved in the New Testament is talking about sanctification, this kind of further deepening of our walk with Christ and our imitation of him and our growth in walking away from kind of our natural sinful tendencies. So humility is a recognition of that we are in process, and that there is a moral littleness about us when compared to Jesus, and that we really are helpless, that we didn't just need the forgiveness of Jesus back then when we, you know, first became a believer or whatever. We need it today. We need, like, today, apart from Jesus, I would be a hopeless case. And so that's what's going on, and just having this deep sense of one's moral littleness and this need for Jesus. Instead of kind of that pursuit that we can get into of saying, you know, of kind of justifying our decisions that are a little bit in gray areas or whatever, you know, humility is about stepping away from that self-justification or any sense of self-conjuring importance, you know. Second, gentleness. This involves anticipating the fragility of others and bringing compassionate sensitivity to our social interactions and relationships. Okay, so what's in those two characteristics that specifically should be speaking to geeks right now? Well, last time we looked back at the first three chapters of Ephesians, and I tried to emphasize the grace, the forgiveness, the power, and the position we've each as believers been given by God. I think Paul and the Holy Spirit provided those as a foundation for the life being described in these verses. Because when I look at the life being described here, I think, holy crap, only God could make me into that kind of person. So that's why I think Paul set the groundwork by emphasizing the grace, the forgiveness, the power, and the position that we have in Christ. So anyway, let's look at these first two character traits that we're being called into. Remembering this entire time that that despite this being this impossible task, we have the tireless grace, forgiveness, and power of Jesus, and that we've been put in a position as His children and as His ambassadors, and He will make us appropriate to that role. So anyway, we're going to take a look at these first two character traits that we're being called into as geeks specifically. The first is humility. Humility is a trait that I just think is immensely lacking among geeks, and I will line up as the title-holding champ for that disgraceful trophy. The lack of humility can and does come in the form of arrogance, but in my experience, arrogant geeks are actually just compensating for insecurity. I've met so many geeks who often unknowingly come off as arrogant know-it-alls, only to discover at some point that they grew up under verbally abusive or overly critical parents. As I get to know them more, I learn that they themselves are actually very insecure, sometimes without realizing and identifying properly, you know, the things about their, you know, inner personality. They don't recognize those as coming out of insecurity, you know. And they're trying to gain security and good reputation through behavior that comes off as arrogance. I've certainly done some of this myself, despite growing up in a warm and loving home. The more common variety of humility deficiency is subtle because it festers in those who have a very low view of themselves and tend to fixate on that to the detriment of their relationships. Matt McKinney edits our speculative faith videos, and he uses a quote from C.S. Lewis in an upcoming video that really caught my eye as I was kind of doing preparation for this study this week. And the quote reads, "Humility isn't thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. Despite having a low opinion of ourselves, we still give tremendous priority to thinking about ourselves. I certainly do. My lack of humility causes me to obsess over what people think of me and whether or not they like or respect me. I replay conversations in my mind and imagine conversations that might happen, all in an effort to feel secure in my standing with others. I also avoid social situations that would take me out of my comfort zone or potentially expose some weakness of mine. In all of this, I'm just wasting time and missing opportunities that could be useful to God's purposes." Now, apologies for the rare sports metaphor, but what came to mind is that I'm choosing to, like, sit on the bench, choosing to sit on the bench in the middle of the freaking Super Bowl. Now, by contrast, Jesus didn't obsess over whether people respected him or not. Now, he wanted them to believe in who he was and to come to him for rescue, but he wasn't concerned about maintaining the respect from others that his nature and identity deserve. He was too busy serving others and living for them to obsess over whether people respected him or not. Philippians 2, verses 6 through 8 in the ESV reads, "Though he was in the form of God..." Jesus did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, in other words, to be gripped tightly and held onto, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And though I'm an infant in this area, I can tell you that there is great freedom in getting our minds on serving others instead of worrying what they think about us. In the moments that God enables me to focus on helping others, even those who are being critical of me, I experience freedom from concern over the opinions of others. That is real life, the way it's meant to be lived. Jesus modeled that for us, and we can enter into that too. All right, so now let's look at gentleness. We geeks are a passionate group of people.
If you don't believe me, well, then you haven't been to YouTube. Or even our forums. We're passionate people, you know? We talk about loving things and hating things, and we attack what we hate and defend what we love. We get on social media and make proclamations of our opinions or wade into the mud in online debates. A simple comment from someone can get our blood pumping and drive us to launch into a passionate monologue. You know, I'm not ready to make a blanket statement that these things are wrong. But I do think that we don't value the skill of gentleness enough. Yes, gentleness is a skill. It's not a feeling, although it can and should be motivated by compassion. When we are ticked off, but still have to go drive somewhere, we don't jam our contact lenses into our eyes. I mean, we know that regardless of how we're feeling, inserting a contact lens requires gentleness if we don't want to destroy the lens or mutilate our eyeball. In the same way, learning to rein in our tone, our pacing, and our word choices is a vital part of living in unity with other believers. It's one thing for our hearts to burn with passion over something. It's another thing to burn people with our passion. I've exchanged a number of text-based communications, email, forum stuff, YouTube comments, etc., where responding to kind of the fiery attitude or passion or whatever, or of another person, responding to that with a gentle attitude causes things to die down and for at least a measure of reason to be restored. If we don't just want to spout off, which I hope is true, if we don't just want to spout off, if we truly want to be heard and to persuade, if we really want to find common ground so that we can have a voice in someone's life, the skill of gentleness is worth developing. Since disagreement is inevitable, gentleness is a vital component in any healthy community of believers. We will fail at being humble, guys. We will fail at being gentle. But because of God's tireless forgiveness and empowering presence, we can get up after every stumble and continue moving deeper into the life God is calling us to. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? What's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we can, but we have to hear from you to do that. You can send an email to me or an audio file recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. All right, I want to thank Winston Crutchfield for his Into the Long Box segment this week. Very cool stuff, Winston. Thank you so much. Stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, I'm going to make another rare exception and review a non-geek genre movie. It's the movie The Case for Christ, which is based on the experience of Lee Strobel, the author of the book The Case for Christ. This is not... I think there was like a documentary version of like The Case for Christ or The Case for Faith, which was basically a re-presentation of the kind of the interview content of the book. But this movie is about the personal journey that Lee Strobel went on that led him to Christ, which covers the same ground in terms of evidence and stuff like that as his book, The Case for Christ. So it's not a documentary. It is a movie. Based on his story of becoming a believer as he set out to basically disprove Christianity and found himself compelled to believe in the truth of Christianity. And I'm reviewing it not just because it's a Christian movie. I usually avoid Christian movies like the plague. But there seems to be this little cluster this spring, in the first half so far of 2017, of Christian movies that seem to be done much better than I would have reason to expect based on Christian movies of the past. And this trailer really caught my eye. And so, I just want to keep my finger on the pulse of what's happening in Christian filmmaking. And hopefully, if this is a good quality movie, then I want to be able to tell you guys about that and recommend that you check it out and that you, share it with other people as well. So, because good Christian movies of any kind bodes well for good Christian geek content going forward. So, anyway, that's my plan for next week. Till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you guys. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampton with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Coming through the wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
And that was Civil Defense. Would you call this a comedy episode, or what?
It's hard to call something with such high stakes in human life a comedy.
And where one no-name does die, actually get dissolved.
Yes, or as I... It's Civil Defense, or as I often call it, Bajoran Wakas! Because we keep hearing that phrase from a recording of Gul Dukat.
The story begins when Sisko, O'Brien, and Jake accidentally trip an old automated program to stop a worker rebellion from back in the occupation days. It's a leftover, but unfortunately everything works, including the poison gas and everything, so they've got to get out of it. But unfortunately, every time they get out of a problem, it escalates and causes a bigger problem.
Because the programming thinks, oh, the revolting workers have escaped from ore processing. Now we have to lock down ops so they can't break in there and kill their Cardassian overlords.
So it's almost like a video game. You beat level 1, level 2 will be more difficult. And the stakes keep raising, and soon the entire station's at stake. We do get to see some amusing stuff. Again, the stakes are too high to really call it a comedy episode, but there's a lot of comedy in it, even if it is dark comedy. Especially Garak and Dukat, because Dukat shows up after he finds out what's going on, and we see what a smug jerk he is. He at first tries to take advantage of this for his own benefit. If you're a Dukat fan, you may not like this because he does not come off looking good, but at the same time, you get some backstory on him, and you find out he and Garak absolutely loathe one another. Apparently, there was a backstory, we don't know all the details, but apparently Garak had betrayed Dukat's father and gotten him killed, and we don't know all the details, and we never hear about it, because we don't need to. It's one of those where the backstory is only hints. But it is amusing to hear them just go back and forth and snipe at each other. And this will keep on through the series. Whenever they're together, they're constantly getting on each other.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to think what else is interesting in this. Well, we can see some more Odo and Quark. Nothing too new there, because we've already seen that they have a frenemy status. We've seen both of them kind of like back the other one up in a tight period, so...
Yeah.
The fact that they're kind of nice to each other at times, that's nothing new. It's nice, it's cool.
Jake Sisko is both useful and courageous in this episode.
Yep, Jake steps up once or twice. It's basically... If you ever saw the old Next Generation episode, Disaster, where the ship just shuts down and everyone's in a different spot and they're all dealing with different dangers, this is kind of like that, except for there's an enemy intelligence behind it. Instead of just random disasters, they've got to work against the plans of this program.
It's actually a malicious program.
It's not an intelligence, but it was made with intelligence, so they have to outwit it. Not much more to say. It's a fairly basic story. I have to admit, I was a little disappointed with the very end, how they finally get out, because it feels like a little too simple and easy, but... And I can live with it, because the crux of it is, they got through with courage and guile.
And of course, like they tell us on Galaxy Quest, It always goes right down to the wire. Yeah,
but it never reaches zero, so they don't know what that is. It
always stops at one on the show.
Actually, no, that's not wrong. It actually did go off, remember?
Yeah, it actually reached
zero. They just found a way to deal with it.
In dealing with it, they were right at the wire.
True. Not much more to this one. It's an enjoyable episode, not at all critical or important to any plot or backstory even, but I would recommend you watch the show anyway. It's a good episode. We'll see you next time for one that's not critical and not very good, Meridian.
And remember, Bajoran viewers, think of your family.